Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein with another conversation. Today we have Peter Wood, who is trained as an anthropologist, was provost at the King's College here in New York City, and for several years now he's been the president of the National Association of Scholars. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we've seen you up here before in the offices. We've had some NAS events here and posted them on the website. And the NAS is, well, how would you characterize it? A watchdog organization, a scholarly confab that has served ever since its founding in the late 80s as a stern intellectual critic of some of the worst trends in higher education. What would you say are the main problems that we should be attending to in higher education today?
American higher education is losing its credibility with a substantial portion of the public. There are good reasons for that. It's not an arbitrary loss, but that loss of credibility will reverberate. The finances are in increasingly bad shape for many colleges and universities. The curriculum is in even worse shape in most places. And the result of this is Americans are rethinking their commitment on many grounds to the whole idea that the best way for late adolescents to enter adulthood is through the portals of the university. Among the reasons for that has been the shift in universities from thinking that their most important task is educating young men and women to their view that their most important task is turning young men and women into advocates of the agenda of the progressive left in this country. That takes several forms. Probably the easiest to get hold of is the idea that they need to engage in the pursuit of social justice more than they need to pursue command of particular subjects or general knowledge. So those are one set of problems. Connected to them is the whole financial model of American higher education. Most colleges and universities derive a very substantial portion of their operating budget from borrowed money. The money is not money they borrow, it's the money that they convince students to borrow and then pay to them in the form of tuition. The whole apparatus of our colleges and universities depends on the continual flow of this support, most of it federal money, some of it state money. But as these institutions lose credibility, the willingness of American people to see substantial portions of their income diverted into repaying loans that in many cases haven't resulted in much in the way of education has begun to erode.
When you say that we've lost some of our credibility of our universities and colleges, people over the years have criticized the university, and defenders have often said, wait a minute, we've got foreign students desperate to come to college campuses and study. We are the envy of the world. Where does that rationalization come off today?
Well, I think there is truth to we are the envy of the world. That doesn't mean we're good. It just means we're the envy of the world. I've been to places like Kazakhstan and Myanmar and talk to people there who would love to attend American universities because the universities in their own countries are so wretched. That we are better than Kazakhstan or Myanmar is not really that much of a boast, but it's also true that students from first world countries that are thriving also want to come to the United States, and there's particular reasons for that. In their own countries, frequently they're tracked from an early age, and if they're not on an academic track at age 13, they're not going to get to go to college at all unless they come to a country like the United States or Canada or Australia.
And those schools are not welcoming all the foreign students.
No.
They simply didn't space for them. It's universities in Italy, for instance.
American higher education loves international students. For the most part, that's because international students pay the full ticket price of tuition, whereas no federal support, no discounting on the part of the institution in the form of grants that
they write the full check.
They write the full check.
That's
so,
right.
Given a choice between admitting a student from mainland China whose English language skills may not be all that good, and admitting a well above average American kid who needs a lot of financial help, most universities will choose the Chinese student.
One thing I've found teaching at Emory in the last few years is it's obvious the foreign student population has gone up significantly, especially the Asian, the East Asian population. And in discussions, I've realized that these are all very wealthy Chinese and Korean students. They're not getting in through. I'm sure they have very strong records, but exactly the money that they have just to shell out the checks is hard to turn down.
There is an irony to this in that our universities, so devoted to social justice and advancement of opportunities, are actually a class-driven organization that caters to wealthy foreigners over Americans, mm-hmm. of any means.
And I would add that the place in which an egalitarian ethos is pushed so strongly is the most hierarchical, complicatedly hierarchical zone on Earth, I think, unless you're talking about a Michelin three-star kitchen. Perhaps from the chef on down, but to the dishwasher. But an enormous focus on prestige, on ranking, and on all the positions one occupies. Chaired professor, full professor, associate assistant, lecturer, adjunct, student, on down. It is a heavily graduated work environment. And I see that, especially when the job market tightens, things get very intense in terms of relative status.
Of course, Americans now are reviewing just how necessary a college degree is to enter that job market. At this particular moment, we have a robust job market and many jobs for which a college degree was not required, but which was becoming de facto a credential, are reverting back to we'll take anybody who is capable, willing, and determined to work hard.
You're seeing that process happen, that the college degree is no longer looked at by employers as that necessity, even if we can't trust GPA anymore. Which they don't. That's why so many of them want to have interns come in for a few months, because we can't trust a resume, we can't trust recommendations anymore, because so many people have A averages and faculty who are willing to praise them to the skies. But they find that college degree isn't a certification, even of effort, or at least a necessary one at this point.
Not only is it not a certification of skill or effort, it is in some cases a warning sign that you may have a individual on your hands whose attitude towards the workplace, towards capitalism, towards America has so soured that this person is not likely to be a very good colleague. And you're in some cases better off getting somebody who hasn't been subjected to 4 or more years of pickling process, in which
right.
one learns that disdain towards one's country is the proper attitude for the up-and-coming class.
Do you think the expressions of disdain for the election of Donald Trump, which were expressed often on college campuses as a form of shame national shame at Hampshire College, a couple kids burning American flags. A lot of riots and protests, and you know, the talk about, I saw emails going back and forth in different places about the return of white supremacy to America. Was that a big part of the growing credibility problem, the election of Donald Trump, and the academic reaction to it?
I think there's evidence that says yes. We have seen these polls taken by Pew and more recently Gallup that show that among people who call themselves Republicans or lean conservative, an absolute majority now think that American higher education is a detriment to the country. Now, there may be people who think it's a detriment to the country, but think we've got to do it anyway for various reasons. But there's this shift in cultural attitudes towards what higher education can provide. And yes, the election of Donald Trump crystallized that. It was already present and growing in some ways. This was the period after the Ferguson riots, the Mizzou affair, and the launch of Black Lives Matter onto college campuses, the 70-some universities that were faced with and generally acceded to what were called the demands. And all of that sort of laid a groundwork that white guilt, black resentment are the governing reality of campus. So Trump fit into that narrative. Yeah. At Pomona College, the office of the Dean of Students rented buses to take students to a anti-Trump rally right after the election. So it's not simply something that's bubbling up from the students. College presidents and other administrators seized the opportunity as a teachable moment, and what they were teaching was that the United States is a rotten country, and the election of Donald Trump is the proof of that. This could not happen in the socially just world that we aim to create.
We were supposed to go from the ideal man to the first woman. And then Mr. Orange Hair, the alpha male throwback, came in and ruined everything. This is just really an atavistic event, I think, for much of maybe all of higher education.
I see it all the time. I have walked careful line. I don't operate an association of people who are defining themselves as politically engaged. It's a National Right. Association of Scholars. Yet we respect the presidency, and I'm determined to get along with whoever happens to be elected.
The NAS was founded precisely, I think the main motivation in the mid-80s was the increasing politicization of teaching and scholarship that dismayed so many people, many of them liberals, who did want to reserve the classroom and the campus as a place where some disinterested knowledge and learning could take place. And that you had some people who joined the NAS early on, such as Eugene Genovese, who said, when I was in school in the 1950s and I was a hard communist, all my teachers were liberals. But they would tell me things such as, you must read the opposite of what you believe. You have got to be exposed to and fairly understand the other side. That's the apolitical nature that although they knew, of course, they're all liberals, but we have to maintain an atmosphere of disinterested pursuit of learning and knowledge, and that the left doesn't believe that. Marx didn't believe that there was such a thing, right? And other leftists in their wake. And so they frankly politicized, especially the humanities. the NAS camp comes along and says, no, no, we can study these things without making it so doggone political all the time. The partisanship is destructive to learning. That's not an advance at all. And I just wonder if one of the things we see now on the campus is the drift of students away from the most politicized parts of the curriculum, the humanities in particular, which has been losing undergraduate market share for a few decades now. Just in the last 6 or 7 years, the plummet in enrollments and majors has happened. Are the students voting with their feet partly for anti-propaganda reasons?
I think that's true. The humanities majors are now at about 5% of the total, which is way, way down from what it once was. The students have gone where? In some cases, they've gone into the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math. Many more of them have gone into the professional areas such as business and nursing, which are relatively unpoliticized. And I emphasize relatively because right. the disease of turning every program into a form of indoctrination and the wonders of diversity and inclusion and social justice really has penetrated every department, even the most unlikely things like mathematics. So yes, students try to shelter themselves from the ministrations of the really hardcore left concentrated in things like English departments and my field, anthropology, but is only a step away from the furnace. They're still in the boiler room.
Right, right, right. Okay, so what do you see happening in the university in the next 5 to 10 years? I mean, we have a financial crunch that a lot of liberal arts colleges are suffering, in terms of the humanities, a lot of colleges are closing yes. humanities departments or consolidating, restructuring them. One main reason being that, you know, I've got a department with 6 full professors and 12 majors. It's financially unworkable to continue this. So they're leaving the humanities. What is going to happen in the humanities? Maybe I'll focus it. What is going to happen in the humanities in the next 5 to 10 years? Are the identity politics just going to keep on going?
Well, we have this quaint institution of tenure, which means that the people who are teaching these departments and chairing them and who are in charge, for the most part, of selecting new faculty members as they come along aren't going anywhere. So if the universities decide to keep these programs going, they're probably going to remain this peculiar cloister of ideologues teaching fewer and fewer students, intensely focused on their curriculum of resentment. But I do have a positive side to say to that, which is that the really worthwhile books, the works of literature, great works of music, are not disappearing. People are finding their way to them, perhaps finding their way to them with more enthusiasm and gusto and capacity to be astonished by them than ever before. My office sits next door to a Barnes & Noble I wandered into yesterday, and Barnes & Noble has tables and many, many shelves of inexpensive paperbacks of Jane Austen, Dostoevsky, Shakespeare. Somebody is buying those books. Barnes & Noble doesn't put them out merely to entertain itself with nostalgia for dead white males and so on. It puts out books that people are buying, books that people think they ought to read, books that people believe that their children ought to read. So I do think that the humanities, to the extent that they represent the great works that have made up the best parts of our civilization, are going to survive in an independent way. And of course, I run an organization that attracts people who care about such things. So I have my finger on the pulse of one part of America that hasn't given up on these things. But I don't think anybody is reading the latest book on gender apparitions and cross-dressing in the works of Toby Smollett or something. It's not the scholarship that has been built around Western civilization has decayed into a triviality that impresses only the fellow trivializers. The students aren't interested in it, and the public isn't interested in it. So the humanities in that sense are dying, but the materials over which they had proper custody for many generations have now escaped their control.
You mentioned Western civilization. Western civilization requirements used to be everywhere in higher education. I was at Stanford last year, and I went in and looked up some old Stanford catalogs and special collections from 1960. Now, Stanford was a very liberal, consciously liberal, sort of leftist-oriented university. Even at that time, it was. But the confidence and the firmness with which they had Western civilization requirements, I found refreshing. You could tell they believed in Western civilization, and that it was necessary for every single student to study it. And that was a liberal, that no liberal would object to that in 1960. Donald Trump gives his speech in Warsaw in favor of Western civilization. And even the Atlantic Monthly, a centrist magazine, accuses him of white nationalism. How do we go from that, from back then to this with Western civilization?
Well, since you ask, one of the projects that the National Association of Scholars undertook a few years ago resulted in a report titled The Vanishing West. We actually went to those college catalogs from years ago and traced how Western civilization survey requirements disappeared. We found in our sample of 50 colleges in 1963, every single one of them had a two-semester required Western civilization sequence.
Everyone.
Every single one of them. By 1980, a few of them still had requirements, but mostly they'd been reduced to one semester, and most other places they were now electives. By 2010, we found one university in the entire country that had and this time we expanded our sample from 50 to, I think it was 110. The Western Civilization Survey course had been completely retired except at William and Mary College. And when our report came out and they found they were standing there all alone, they abolished it.
So it's your fault.
Yes.
We could have kept it going under the radar, Peter.
I'm afraid that sort of thing has happened to me more than once, where we've celebrated a rare survival only to see it snatched away.
Well, it's a copycat world, certainly in higher education. No one wants to be out there alone.
That doesn't really answer your question of why this happened.
Yeah, and the 60s and 70s, the multiculturalist, black studies, women's studies, the third world anti-colonialist efforts. Just recast Western Civ.
Right. There was a narrative that came along, and multiculturalism is probably the easiest label to put on it. This sense that the only thing that is unusual about the West was that it was successful in exporting its
Guns?
Guns, germs, and steel, as Professor Diamond called it, that we've been uniquely to blame for the ills of the world, but there's nothing of positive value in the study of the West that deserves to be given a privileged place in the curriculum. But let me add that privileged place was earned, and it was acted on. So it wasn't just that the Western Civilization Survey course sat there as a once-and-done requirement that students had to get through. It really provided the armature for the whole humanities curriculum and much of the sciences as well. It was the apparatus through which the university organized the curriculum as a whole. And when it was banished at Stanford with hey, hey, ho, ho, Western culture's got to go, but with similar moves around the country, when that happened, it wasn't replaced by some other kind of coherent curriculum. Multiculturalism was just a open sesame to doing whatever you want to do.
Well, this is what I've come to learn. The promise of multiculturalism was that we would end up with a richer, more diverse, more deep, and more historically accurate rendition of the past. We'd have more cultures. People would know more. Students would come. We weren't really going to get rid of Western Civ. We were just going to, again, enrichen the tradition, and that students would graduate knowing more, having more historical, more literary, more cultural knowledge. Peter, you want to comment on that?
Well, I am an anthropologist. I was an undergraduate anthropology major at Haverford College in the early 1970s, and I fully bought into the idea that knowing something about peoples around the world was an enriching thing. And I went on to get my PhD in this field. But along the way, I discovered that I was among perhaps very few anthropologists who really took the idea seriously. Most anthropologists are narrow specialists in one particular tribe, place, village somewhere in the world, and that doesn't mean that they command a enriching multiculturalist perspective. They just are Igbo-centric or Nuer-centric, mm-hmm, or some, mm-hmm, pick your tribe. The result of anthropology is that it's as a concept of studying humanity as a whole and being aware of how the differences and similarities mount up to a picture of who we are has faded away. Most anthropologists these days study themselves. They pick people whom they are already familiar with and write semi-autobiographical accounts of their experience there. The field has collapsed almost as completely, or perhaps even more so than English.
Is this part of the credibility factor, not only the politicization, the partisanship, the anti-Americanism, but we're finding more and more students who graduate are simply not that learned. A college degree hasn't seemed to make them more knowledgeable. They aren't more bookish. They haven't read that much.
Well, they arrive in college now without the habits of reading. It's rare to find the ambitious student who has gone beyond the high school curriculum to read other important books. And the important books that are included in the high school curriculum are dwindling away, oftentimes to small selections from, right, longer works. This has been registered by colleges and universities who now know that the students arriving on campus will have read nothing in common or very little. They've instituted a summer reading program regimen to try to put a Band-Aid on that.
Let's make them all read the same book. And so they teach St. Augustine's Confessions. They make them all read five of Shakespeare's tragedies, right, Peter?
No, they tend to pick books that have been published in the last 5 years on socially trendy topics. Much of that is politicized. They will pick books on social justice.
Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Ta-Nehisi
popular Coates. One.
Yes, very popular. I think he's number one on our list this year. We do an annual study of these, what we call beach books. The classics are out, and by classics here, one can be very generous and say anything published before 1990 might be a classic, because precious few books that old are even considered. But there's also this issue of what are the students capable of reading? We hear over and over again from the people who run these programs that we dare not assign more difficult books because so many of our students, incoming students, are book virgins.
They can't cut it.
They can't do it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The reading level of most of these required summer readings is ninth grade for college freshmen. Now, that's just one indicator of where the problem lies here. The students who come in so ill-prepared for a serious intellectual journey do not suddenly bulk up and become really interested in wide-ranging studies. Or if they are, they are in need of finding the rare professor who is willing to invest in the time to guide them through the thicket of the modern curriculum.
This is the advice to give the parents out there whose kids are going to college. They have to be vigilant. Find those professors who are going to make you work, who are going to make you read, who will take the time to sit down with you and talk about ideas and books and history and literature. The college is not going to automatically do this for you. You have to take some initiative, because they all have some good professors who are conscientious and darn good teachers, but you've got to pick and choose pretty carefully.
There may well be good courses in that curriculum, but they are needles in the haystack, and the curriculum itself is not organized in a manner that naturally leads students to find those courses. The way it usually works is that the major will specify that you have to have a certain number of courses in your field. Beyond that, the university has distribution requirements, so you may need to take a course in the humanities, but it can be one of 300 courses if
right.
you're at a big university.
Right. No, you have to set your own curriculum, right? You've got to pick and choose. All right, Peter, people can go to nas.org.
Yes.
To see about the reports that you mentioned, the activities the National Association of Scholars is doing, and what the plans are next.
Yes, we are a membership organization, so people can join us at a modest fee. We produce a quarterly journal. We have regional meetings around the country. We just had one at Grove City College in Pennsylvania, and have one at Chapman University in Southern California in January, so you can meet us in person if you want to do a little bit of traveling. And our reports are all available for free digitally. We also have printed copies of most of them for a modest fee. So we are a kind of bulldog in the establishment. We give trouble to a lot of colleges and universities when we think they're falling down on the job in a particularly bad way. And we're involved in most of the fights you probably already heard about, such as the lawsuit against Harvard and its discrimination against Asian students.
Well, that'll be interesting. All right, Peter, thank you.
Thank you.